Is the red light blinking on the back of the camera?
Yes.
Okay, we are in business. Welcome back. I hope your Pesach was wonderful. Siddurim, matzah, and so on. The weather is finally spring-like. Hopefully that lasts, you know, beyond today. Yeah, you start to feel like Job. If things are good, just wait till tomorrow. Yeah. So we are now up to round two. And what I'm hoping to do is to finish round two before the summer break. That's my goal. Which would then leave us next year with round three, the mysterious fourth visitor by the name of Elihu and his speech, God's response to Job. That's what I would like to... I think if we can finish round two, we're in good shape. And if we can't, well, you know, that happens too. But we'll see. I don't actually know when we break for the summer. I'm going to rely on Rebecca to one week turn the lights out and say, okay, that's it. So we'll see how that goes. But round one, well, going back to the beginning, just as it's been a couple of weeks at this point, you will recall Job begins as the Tam V'Yashar, the one who is complete, righteous, Yirei Elokim, God-fearing, and we discussed a little bit about what that meant. He had great wealth, he had a wonderfully large family, they seemed to get along, they ate their meals together, they would have these great feasts, and Job would have them participate in offerings afterwards to atone for any mistakes that were made, even in thought, during that time. We talked about that a little bit. That's come up actually repeatedly, this concern that he has even for being judged for one's thoughts. Everything is wonderful for him until the Satan lays eyes on him, and the Satan says to God, no one really worships you, no one's really interested in serving God. And God says, well, what about Job? He's wonderful. He at least can prove that human beings are capable of achieving this high level. And the Satan says, yeah, I'm going to show you. Takes away Job's family, takes away Job's wealth. Job still does not protest. He says, all of these things are things that God gave me, therefore God has the right to take them away, working with the assumption that God is in fact the one taking them away. And then he gets permission, the Satan gets permission to strike Job himself, and Job is struck with terrible, painful boils. Job's wife, as yet another blow against Job, says to him, give up. You should bless God, and the term for blessing God, which we saw repeatedly in the beginning of the book, is a reference to blasphemy. Blaspheme against God and die. Job, at that point, expresses his misery, although he has not blamed God overtly. That's when the three visitors show up. They sit there quietly for a week, and their silence, even though it is praised in the Talmud as proper conduct for people sitting with a mourner, that they shouldn't speak until the mourner speaks, nonetheless, their silence seems to be what pushes him over the edge, and what makes him finally respond harshly to the suffering that he is experiencing. At that point, we had the first round, and in the first round, the major theme that we saw was the statement that even though Job believes there is no proper reward and punishment in this world, we saw two different ways to read that, whether he believes that God punishes people too harshly and is too minute in his judgment. He punishes people even for the smallest of offenses. That was one way to take it. Or alternatively, the belief that God isn't actually in charge, that God has put the constellations in charge and people's fates are sealed from the day they are born, whichever approach. The visitors tried to convince Job that no, there actually is justice. And that comes in the form of Eliphaz saying, it's true that God punishes people for even minor things, but there is great reward as well, so you should turn to God and come to God and your story will have a happy ending. Or whether you take the approach of Bildad, that sometimes things seem to be negative, but they are actually positive, you just have to wait and see. Or whether you take the approach of Sofar, who said that that what did Silver say? Right, that people are punished for their failure to live up to their potential. So it's even beyond being punished for sin; it's being punished for failure to produce the way you could have. And and there were all sorts of nuances, and you know, that's why it took us a year. But the upshot of all of this is that, as we saw in the last few weeks before Pesach, they have not convinced Job. Job's response to them is, "You all think you're so smart. You're not saying anything I don't know. I am older than you, at least older than Zophar, possibly older than Bildad as well, and I'm not impressed by what you have to say. You don't have insight that that I lack, and what I would really like is to bring God up on charges. I would like to address God directly, to sue God, so to speak," but he really doesn't mean to sue. What he really means is to judge, and have God respond to the judgment that Job has made. And we saw in this last speech of his quite a bit of this litigation type of language. That all brings us to round two. So, in round two, which is shorter than round one, good news, the speeches tend to be shorter in round two, we're going to see the following themes from the visitors. Number one, strong emphasis on the suffering of the wicked. The idea that people who sin do get zapped. Why that matters, I'm going to come back to in a minute. But that's the major theme that emerges here in this round. And number two, a strong implication of Job for his own alleged wickedness in both words and deeds. There might be some sheets left on the back table. I don't know. Oh, you had the last one, Dahlia?
No, I put it on
out. Okay. Thanks. Okay. So that's the those are the two themes that we see from the visitors. The Job himself is going to respond by saying, "My visitors are hopelessly wrong." Number one. They don't know what they're talking about. And as far as people who do bad things, no, they don't suffer. There's no punishment for them. So on the one hand, he is dismissive by saying that, just in general, they don't know what they're talking about, what they have to say, I know what they're telling me and I don't believe them. And number two, saying that wicked people don't suffer. So I have two critical questions to ask even before we start to see the beginning of round two with Eliphaz's speech. Critical question number one, given what I just said, that the major theme in this round is going to be the visitor saying to Job, wicked people do suffer, why is it valuable for them to talk to Job about the suffering of the wicked? My second question is going to be, do they really believe that wicked people suffer? I mean, have they not, like, opened their eyes, seen the world? What planet are they living on? That's going to be the second question. But the first question is, why does it matter? If Job's primary problem is, I am a good person and I shouldn't be suffering, or even if I have sinned, God is punishing me inappropriately for what I've done wrong, why is it valuable for them to say to Job, wicked people do suffer? What would you say, Sharon?
Are they insinuating that he's really wicked, that he's really bad?
Right. So one, right, good. One approach is to say that what this really is a statement not about the wicked in general, some kind of entity that exists out there, but they're pointing a finger. They're saying, Job, wicked people suffer, and that's why you have to go through what you're going through. And that's absolutely one way to read this. Susan, you were going to say?
I think, in a way, maybe they're justified. Like, it's very hard to live with why you see this happening and you know people are good or whatever. I don't care what period of time that was. And I think whether it's a higher power or whatever, people want justification. There has to be justification why this is happening. So maybe they were trying to say to Hitch, it's not necessarily a joke. The reason this is happening is because that's why. Otherwise, it wouldn't be.
So are they pointing a finger at him then?
I don't know if they're necessarily pointing. I think they're using him, but I think it's a more
global statement. It's a statement that there is justice in this world, and you may be a casualty of the system, but there is a system. Could be. Take a look on your sheets, please, at the first source. a problematic Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot, you will recall, is part of the Mishnah, but it tends not to discuss what we think of as law, but rather to discuss ideals, whether in terms of the way people behave with each other, or whether in terms of people's relationship with God, particularly the imperative to study Torah, is discussed in Pirkei Avot. Leave it be. This isn't a class about Pirkei Avot. Take a look at the first source. Nitai Ha'arbeli, Nitai of Arbel, Omer, he said the following. Harchek mishachein ra, distance yourself from a bad neighbor. Ve'al tischaber la'rasha, do not join a wicked person. I'm not going to spend time really on those first two clauses because they're not our point right now. But what he is telling you is, number one, if you're next to somebody who's bad, run away. And number two, if you're not with somebody who's bad, don't go joining in with those who are bad. Don't become part of their group. Ve'al titya esh min ha'pur'anut. And don't abandon hope of punishment. And the term, really, when I translated it this way, is don't abandon hope of punishment. It suggests there is such a thing as hope of punishment. What in the world is Nitai of Arbel talking about here in this Mishnah? When he says don't abandon hope of punishment. Yeah?
Justice.
So it's not really about punishment, it's about justice. Then why did he word it in terms of punishment? There are words for punishment, for justice.
I don't speak Hebrew, so I don't know.
Okay. He could have said...
The etymology of the word.
Right. So puranut really is a term that's used for punishment specifically. You could have said din, which is, you know, logical justice, or mishpat, which is justice under statutes and laws. But onish would be punishment. Yeah, the puranut is really... A term for suffering that is caused in response to having done something wrong. He's focused not on saying, he's not saying there is justice in this world. He's saying people get hurt in this world, and it's because they were bad people. Like, this comes out of nowhere. What is he doing, Shaina?
I always think of Purim meaning more taking of accounts, like Lumatreya.
Interesting.
So if it's taking of accounts, then that's not quite the same as punishment. That's part of a larger scheme.
It's an interesting point. I would think to relate peranut to peraon, which is payment. That's the and it is. It's a settling of scores, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it always shows up in the negative. We never find that I can think of, and you know, there are always cases I don't think of. But I don't think we ever find peranut used for a positive. Paul, and then I'm gonna go around.
Yeah. You say don't be tempted to join them because they're they're going to eventually be punished.
Right. So the general approach to these Mishnayot and Pirkei Avot, that when you have these triplets, the sets of three, is to assume that they're all speaking to the same point, just different aspects of it. So I would agree with what Paul is saying, that this is sort of responding to the first two. You may see your bad neighbor thriving and think, well, he's doing okay. And you may see the Rasha, the wicked person, is doing okay, and say to yourself, yeah, what's the big deal? You know, I'll invest with them, so to speak. And so what he's saying is, you should know bad things are coming for them. It's not all going to be wonderful. The only problem I have with that read is this verb, titya'esh, which suggests you're hoping for there to be a downfall. I have some issues on that front. I saw Diana had something?
No, I was going to say the
similar thing, okay.
So, but you wouldn't take it the other way, you know, why good things happen to bad people? So always answer, so that would be the second possible thought I had looking at that, which is, you sit there waiting for, you see bad people having no problems, so don't worry, in the long run, there will be.
Right, and that's a possible read. Yeah. But yeah, it does have to be hope.
Yeah,
isn't
it? That's what I was saying. Like, maybe at a personal level, you should know that you should always worry in your head that you should act properly, or you'll have that zero punishment. I mean,
yeah.
The word hope, I can't.
It's really awkward, but that's the wording. Elijah.
Okay, sorry. I think when I learned it, and maybe this, I learned it wrong, but I learned it as don't be weakened from your punishment. That when you get punished for doing these wicked things, don't weaken from it because sort of you, there will be hope for, you know, you can turn your life around, so to speak.
Yeah. So that's the fun thing about Pirkei Avot. is you can do an awful lot with it, and people do. You know, one of the challenges I always have when I was in the shul rabbinate is that they expect you to give a class every year between Pesach and Shavuos about Pirkei Avot. And it's like, yeah, how much am I really going to say about this Mishnah over and over again, year after year after year? So you look for different angles. And we'll look at this aspect and that aspect and so on. But you could, what you're doing essentially is retranslating the word min. Instead of saying min, meaning from, as in don't give up hope from punishment happening, now it's don't give up hope as a result of. Which is drash. I wouldn't call it pshat. I wouldn't say that. Look, those who were here last year know, I love drash. That's okay. Having said that, I want to focus on the other half of what you did with it, which is making it personal. It's not about punishment of others. It's about punishment of oneself. If you take a look at the second source, Avot D'Rabbi Natan is a critical text for reading Pirkei Avot. Meaning, Avot D'Rabbi Natan is from roughly that time period, the period of the Tanaim, the sages who, in fact, record the Mishnayot and Pirkei Avot, but it's an expansion. It also goes a little bit later in time, but it's an expansion on the ideas that are seen in much of Pirkei Avot, and what it gives you is often a much richer understanding of what the Mishnayot are trying to say, because for the most part, the Mishnayot and Pirkei Avot, the lessons there are very terse, and they don't give you a lot of detail. Avot D'Rabbi Natan will expand and give you a whole new perspective on what's going on. So take a look at source number two, which is indeed the expansion on what we saw in source number one. Ketzad, it quoted, I just omitted it for space, but they quoted the Al Tityayish Min HaPuranut, not to abandon hope of punishment. And then they ask, Ketzad, how so? Melamed Sheyehei Libo Shel Adam Mitpached B'chol Yom. It teaches that one's heart should fear daily. Mitpached is an interesting construct. Usually we would see it as mitpached, but it's the same idea. That one should fear for oneself. V'yomari should say, Oy li, woe is me. Shema tavo alai puranut hayom. Maybe I will be punished today. V'shema lamachar, maybe tomorrow. V'nimsa mitpached b'chol yom, and so he will fear every day. Shenamar kein be'iyov, as Iyov said, pachod pachadeti, in his first speech. Job said, I was very afraid. So the first idea is that a person, when he says don't give up hope of punishment, what it's actually saying is a person should anticipate being punished and think about that as something that's, you know, is going to happen to him possibly today. Davar acher, alternatively, Al Tityayish Min HaPuranut, the same quote from the Mishnah, do not give up hope of punishment. Ketzad, how so? Bizman Shadom Ro'em Mashabi Adom Matzliach, when a person sees that he's succeeding. Al Yomar, Bishvil shezachiti natan li amakom machal mishteh b'olam hazeh v'akaren kayem et li l'olam haba. A person shouldn't say, I've been a good guy, and that's why God has given me food and drink in this world, and the core reward for what I've done is actually coming in the next world. I'm eating off the interest right now, but the karen, the core amount, is waiting for me in the next world. I'm good. Ela Yomar, rather he should say, no. Oily, woe is me. Shemalon in Seili Lefanav, Ela Zuchut Echad Bilvad. Maybe I only have one merit in front of God. And that's why he gave me the good that I now enjoy, so that he can destroy me in the next world.
Jewish guilt.
Totally. But not just that, it's enshrined in Pirkei Avot now. This is the way you should look at life. Ha! Boy, oh boy. You thought Job was the depressing part of this class. This is Pirkei Avot. It is encouraging a person to second guess and to say, maybe I am not yet the person I am supposed to be. Yeah, even if it's, well, not even if it's good, it's bad, but even if it's good, tomorrow is bad. It's the way we look at the weather. Shana.
You know, the dark reading underneath this to me is like the abused child and the abused spouse who says, well, at least he's paying attention to me.
Hmm. Well, that's true for much of Job. In other words, that's what the visitors have been saying to Job all along, right? You know, God is close and God is watching and God is punishing. And Job, for his response at one point, said, I wish he wouldn't watch me so closely, frankly. But what this is sort of one side of what Judaism does. You know, I'm a big fan of the statement which is attributed to various Hasidic rabbis. I don't know which one actually said it. That he used to keep a piece of paper in each pocket, right? You're familiar? In one it said Anochi Afar Va'efer, which is what Abraham said, I am dust and ash, I don't have the right to have anything. And then on the other hand, the statement from the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, the world was created for me. A person needs a balance of both. And Nitai of Arbel is being the party pooper, right? Nitai is giving you the one that's in the pocket that you don't want to look at. The idea was, you look at both, and this is what informs you as you go through life. But Nitai is presenting the negative. And what he's saying is that a person has to worry about his own future. Frankly, this is a hard read of the phrase Al Titya'esh, because again, Al Titya'esh means don't give up hope of punishment happening. Whereas what he's saying is, worry about punishment happening. But I bring this here to go back to our initial question. We said, for those who came in the middle, one of the major themes, if not the major theme, of this round of speeches of Job's visitors, which is going to begin for us as soon as we get started on it, on page 1639 in the Stone Tanakh, one of their major themes is going to be wicked people suffer. And our question is, why in the world do you want to say this to Job, whose point has been anything but? His point has been, you know, why is God making me suffer? So when we look at this Mishnah here, when we look at the statement of don't give up hope of punishment, it could be that what they're saying is, you know, you had it good, but wicked people suffer, and eventually, yes, this is appropriate for you to experience this as a response to your deeds. There's a chair right here. As a response to your deeds, this is coming to you. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it, and this is maybe me trying too hard to put a positive spin on things, but another way to look at it is justice has two hands. Justice takes, but it also gives. You know, when people say, I wish that God would just, you know, be very kind, what they're doing is saying, I wish that God was not just. I wish there was no punishment and no negatives and no bad things happened. I would just like God to, you know, give out candy all day long. So what you want is that there should be no justice, because that's not a system of justice. But flipping that on its head here, perhaps what they're saying to Job is, there is justice. And yes, wicked people will suffer, but that also means that good people will get rewarded. That there's going to be a positive side as well. Frankly, if this is really what they meant, I wish they would have said that. But maybe that's a way to put a happy face on what is really a dark set of chapters coming up, in which they're just going to spend time trying to tell Job, bad people are miserable. That's essentially what they're going to be presenting to him. So again, we see that one of their themes is, then the major theme in this round is going to be, Job, wicked people suffer. We have to understand why this is a good thing for them to say to Job in his current state, and we've talked about it a little bit, but again, I'm setting the stage for what's coming in the weeks to come. The other question, though, that I think is a really important question is, do they really believe this? Do they really believe that bad people get, so to speak, what's coming to them? And I brought you a paragraph from Newsom's book, which I've been quoting all year long, because I think it's a great read. If you take a look at source number 3, she writes the following. Whenever I teach the book of Job, I find it almost impossible to get a class to entertain, even as a hypothetical possibility, that these poems might be true. It seems obvious that stories about the fate of the wicked are patently false. After all, the students can all name counterexamples. For myself, I do not know whether I believe the story told by the friends about the fate of the wicked is true. I do, however, think that it is one of the most complex, difficult, and provocative claims made in the book, and that it is not adequately refuted in the way my students initially attempt. In other words, saying, "You can't tell me wicked people suffer, I see wicked people who don't suffer," that's not an adequate response. Saying, "That's not my experience," is not an adequate response. And her reason for saying that, as she develops through a chapter on the topic, is that she thinks that's not really what they're saying. When they say wicked people suffer, what they're actually talking about is something much larger than "I have seen bad people come to a bad end." And what it is that they are, that she thinks, and that I think, frankly, also, that they're saying is something I want to come back to at the end of Eliphaz's speech. So we have to go through this chapter first, and then I want to come back to this point. But it's something to keep in mind, to ask ourselves, what are they trying to accomplish here by saying this to Job? And what is it that they're really expressing about the world when they say wicked people suffer? So those are some heavy thoughts and heavy things to think about. We're not going to finish this theme this week. This is going to be a carryover to next week as well. But that's what I wanted to set up as the framework here. Clear? Somewhat, hopefully? Good. Eliphaz, who is going to be the speaker here in chapter 15. So remember that the last time he spoke were chapters 4 and 5. We considered him then and still consider him to be the most senior among them. He is also the most poetic among them. He is of the belief that there is divine justice, that just because you're a good guy doesn't mean you never sin and doesn't mean you don't deserve punishment. If you take a look at source number 4, I'm not going to read it aloud right now because we saw this in the introduction to his first speech, but I just brought it here from Maimonides. Maimonides says that Eliphaz's belief is that Job has indeed sinned and that that's why he's getting punished. And what Eliphaz had said first time around is that Job is a good guy, generally speaking. And he only needs to turn to God. Wicked people do suffer. He mentioned that the first time around as well. But he says, you can't be more righteous than God. You remember we spent a lot of time on his verse, "Ha'enosh me'alokai yitzdak." Can a person be more righteous than God? Can a person win, so to speak, in his litigation against God? He was really the first one to propose litigation in the book. So he's coming back to that here, and he's going to say, "Job, you better watch out, because what you're saying is dangerous." If you take a look at source number 5, you get a summary from Malbim to what Eliphaz is going to say. He says, "Vidat Eliphaz, the view of Eliphaz is, Shatzlachat harasha hi rak hatzlacha meduma. When the wicked appear to succeed, it's only imaginary. It's not real. Ve'ina hatzlacha amitit, it's not true success. Sha'gam shalafira ota ayin tir'eyu matzliach, even though, to the eye, it seems that he is indeed succeeding. Osef hon v'chayel v'kinyanim, he is gathering wealth, he's gathering might, he's gathering acquisitions. Libo tamid malei pachad." He says, "I have news for you. This wicked person, he's always afraid. He's always insecure. V'domelo tamid kilu nirdach b'pnei cherev. He imagines himself pursued by the sword. U'ki'ilu kvari sigeyu resh v'oni v'chol ra'ot hazman, as though poverty, suffering, and all of the evils of the time have already caught him in his own head. Achli bolo yismach me'oshro. His heart is not happy with all of his wealth. He's forever needing to amass more because he's afraid he's going to lose that which he already has. V'yirgaz v'yidag v'yitbahel tamid. He suffers roges, which has been a magic word all through this book. He suffers turmoil. He is worried. He is upset constantly." That's the way that Eliphaz is going to portray the wicked person's lot in life.
Yeah. It's very Shakespearean. I mean, if you have a play and it's set in the beginning, middle, and end, sure, that's how things are going to pan out. But, I think in real life, I don't think that's
right. And that's why we have to go back to that question of, does he really think this is true? And there's a lot to be said, so hang in there on that.
But
yeah,
at the beginning of the book, Job was always afraid too. He was afraid his sons were going to do
yep.
things right. And yet he thought of himself as a very righteous man.
Indeed, we have to ask ourselves, is he describing Job? Is that what he's trying to do? Is he painting a picture and saying, Job, do you recognize this person? I think that's a legitimate question. That could well be what he's trying to do. One thing that is remarkable, I said that Eliphaz, as the most senior, is also the most poetic. He has remarkable imagery that he draws on in this. We're going to see that. Quite a few of his verses make it into the Talmud and are used to build ideas, as we're going to see. I'll mention some of them as we go along. He likes to play with words. He uses words to present he uses a word in multiple places with different meanings. So we're going to see the word Tigram meaning one thing in verse 4 and another thing in verse 8. We're going to see the word Cholelet mean one thing in verse 7 and another in verse 20. Ruach in verse 2 will mean one thing. In verse 13, it's going to mean something else. He's going to play with the word Shav and use it two different ways in the same verse in verse 31. So there's a certain appreciation. If your Hebrew is good, you get an appreciation for what he's doing, not just thematically, but also linguistically. But the basic outline is actually relatively simple. I put it at the bottom of the first side of your sheet. He's going to begin taking 15, 16 verses just to say, Job, you're wrong. That's the first half of his speech, which is sort of, we've seen that from his visitors. His visitors like to spend time pointing out he's wrong, and he, for his part, likes to spend time putting them down as well. So, you know, this is maybe just their nature of their relationship. But that's going to be the first half of his chapter. He's going to spend a lot of real estate on that. Then he's going to spend the next 7 or 8 verses with point number 1, which is that the wicked suffer emotionally, which we've seen Malbim referred to already. And then point number 2 he's going to make is that the wicked have no future. What they build does not endure, as though what everybody else builds does. But yeah, Susan.
Every time they talk about the wicked,
yeah,
they're talking about wicked people, or they're talking about punishment. Nowhere do they talk about children who have been punished, or small, you know, people whose children die after a month. Or nowhere do they explain why punishment would start so young if they can't be wicked yet. They explain, you know, the sins of the fathers, but they leave that whole part of wickedness out of their definition of what wicked is.
So I have good news and bad news. The good news is they will in this very chapter. The bad news is you're not going to like what they say. We already saw a little bit of foreshadowing of this in Bildad. Bildad's first speech, remember, he said, Job, your kids must have done something wrong. So we did see a reference to that there, but we don't know how old Job's kids are. They seem to be adults. They have their own houses.
And that was specific.
But in this chapter, he's going to talk about the children of the wicked, and he's going to present them suffering for the sins of their parents.
Or wicked who seem good.
Yeah. I mean, the whole other thing, which I thought you were going to go with when you started, is we haven't defined wicked.
Yes.
And I have news to you. He's not going to define wicked either. He doesn't care. We will get others later on who will. But Eliphaz sort of presents you with this black box called wicked person and then describes what happens to them. That's really much more his focus as opposed to giving instruction about what good behavior looks like and bad behavior looks like. He's not trying to tell Job, you did this wrong, you should have done that. Later speakers will, but as far as he's concerned, there's this thing called wicked, and what I care about is what God does to them.
I don't think if he had a definition of wicked, he could apply it to the Job we've been talking about with the kind of speeches he makes.
Maybe. We'll have to see. He also, keep in mind, Eliphaz gets 3 speeches. This is only round 2. Yeah.
Why is he talking about the wicked? Job is
Oh, Oh yeah, well they're definitely upsetting him more than anything. That's for sure. Since day one, they've been upsetting him. But in terms of what they're doing, I think it's what you had said in the beginning of the class, which is that I think part of this, at least, is them saying to Job, punishment is coming, and it's coming for you, and you should see yourself in this story, in this narrative that I'm presenting. So let's actually take a look at it. We spent 35 minutes on explaining what Eliphaz is going to say. That's our quota. You know, now let's actually, you know, see what he says. So as I said, his first chunk here is just rejecting Job's words. We are, once again, if you're using the stone Tanakh, we're on page 1639, the beginning of chapter 15. Vayan Eliphaz Atemani Vayomar, the same way all of the speeches begin, Eliphaz declared, and then we talked about him being from Teman, and what Teman is, that's old news. Hachacham Yane Dat Ruach Vimalei Kadim Bitno, ? This is a question that he's asking. The giveaway is the opening letter Hey, which indicates that this is a question. Also, I see the stone Tanakh has a question mark, so that's good. But he says, will a wise man, ya'aneh, either answer or declare, you could render it either way, will a wise man declare dat ruach, the intelligence of the wind, meaning something that is empty, something that is not tangible, something that is here and gone. Vimalei kadim bitno. Kadim is the east wind. Will the east wind fill his belly? Meaning that you call yourself wise, Job. You actually did in the previous chapters. You talked about yourself as being wise. If you were to go back to, and I'm not saying everybody should, but if you were to go back to Job's response to the previous speaker at the end of round one, Job said, oh sure, there are a lot of you, and with you, with all of you, wisdom will die. You think you possess all wisdom. I have a heart like you. I am no less than you. Who doesn't know the things you're saying? That's what Job had said. So Eliphaz gives as good as he gets and says, for a wise man, you're speaking empty words. Hocheach bedavar lo yiskon. You educate, lahochiach, which is a word that Job had used about what he wanted to do for God. He was going to educate God back in chapter 13, verse 3. So he uses Job's word back against him and says, the person who teaches, educates, rebukes, if you want to translate hocheach that way, bedavar lo yiskon, with something that fails to nourish. Like kahaskein hiskanti, well, that's actually not a word like that, but like sochenet by Avishag for King David, the lo yiskon, you provide words that don't nourish. Umilim lo yo'ilbam, and words that have no benefit. What you're saying is nothing. That's what Eliphaz said. It's a very interesting change. It's worth taking a second. Go back to chapter 4, the beginning of chapter 4, please. This is when Eliphaz spoke the first time. It's worth seeing this. One of the things that I really am hoping to get across here, I hope I am succeeding in making the argument, is page 1625, is that this book does have structure. We spent time in the beginning pointing out how hard it is to learn this book because it seems like there's a speech saying this and a speech saying that, and this is repetitive and this is redundant. But there is a structure going on. You can see consistency and development within the speeches of Eliphaz. You can see him getting angrier, actually, across his speeches. But he has consistent arguments to make. He responds in kind. Job uses this word. He's going to use this word back. There is a structure. It's just a really hard book, and that makes it difficult to see it. But go back to chapter 4, and you see that there, Eliphaz was apologetic, almost, in beginning his speech. His response to Job, when Job was harsh, he said, you know, can I just say something to you? You know, after all, you used to speak to people when they suffered, so I now want to be the one to speak for you. It was a much more respectful beginning. He has now seen Job respond to him, respond to Bildad, respond to Zophar, and he's lost that element of respect and apology. And he begins by saying, you know, the things you're telling me, Job, they're very unimpressive. There's nothing here that I find beneficial in your words. And he says, Af ata tafer yira vitigra sicha lifnei kel. And this is a very important line. He says, you, Job, tafer, cancel, nullify, yira. Now, what is yira? Awe is the way they translate it here in the stone. Those who are using another Tanakh, what do you have? Fear?
Fear.
No, it's in the stone. It's awe. It's sentence. It's chapter 5, sentence 4.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Chapter 15, sentence 4. I was close.
Piety.
That's interesting.
Devotion.
Interesting. Okay, now we're talking. Well, what do you do with the second half of the sentence then?
That's the second. Yes, thou dost away with fear and impairs devotion before God.
Interesting. I know why they did devotion now. Now that makes sense, but we'll come back to that. The way that the stone renders it, back on page 1639, is you have undermined awe and have diminished prayer before God. And I think they're taking devotion as prayer. I think they don't mean devotion emotionally, they mean a devotion as a prayer. Is that the way the other Tanakh, I heard fear versus awe in the first half, but that's basically the way they take it. So what is he alleging about Job?
His words are meaningless.
Maybe.
Or are you, I think what he's trying to say is that if you continue with Eos worldview, then there's no point to prayer, there's no point in supplicating, there's no point in having a dialogue or relationship with God. What's happening is written in the stars, and you're going to be zapped, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right. The logical end of your arguments, Job, is that there's nothing to God's role in this world, and therefore reverence is meaningless and will get you nowhere, and why should people devote to themselves? Why should people pray? That's one way to look at this. Yeah.
The book here says that his words are calculated to destroy religion.
Mm-hmm. Even stronger, in other words.
Yes.
So this is one way to take it. I would only ratchet it up a notch. If you remember the beginning of Sophar's speech, Sophar said to Job, I have to answer you because no one else is. And we looked at it and said, what do you mean no one else is? All the people we know of who are present have certainly spoken. So far as the third of three. And our answer was, there may be other people present for this dialogue who are silent and so far is concerned about the impact on them. And that could be what Eliphaz is saying. It's not just saying the logical conclusion for you is that you won't revere God and you won't pray. But I'm worried about the listeners. You are causing these people who are listening to your speeches to say, let me just chuck this all. I don't need it. Job is right. He was a good man. He did what God wanted him to do. And yet, he is suffering. He himself is the one who is telling me now that there's no point in all of this service of God. So let me go out and have a cheeseburger. Again, we don't know if they're Jewish or not in this story, so maybe cheeseburgers are fine for them. They list one of the seven Noahide laws. But the point is that you're going to cause all the people in the room to abandon religion. Yes, Rebecca.
The word sikha you're taking is prayer, which
I want to come. I'm coming.
It's a one way. Maybe I'm limited in thinking as being much more of a one way street. Sikha really is much more conversation.
Right. So I want to come to that word. It's a hard word to render here. Well, let's talk it through now. The word sicha, normally as it's used, or not normally, but frequently as it's used, actually means idle chatter or meaningless conversation. That's usually the usage of the word sicha. And there are some popular references to it that you can see. I know which one you're thinking of. The word sicha is usually almost a negative. So when Pirkei Avot presents the 48 traits of somebody who grows in Torah, one of them is mi'ut sicha, right? Those who get my Omer emails, I think we did this one the other day, or it's coming up in the next couple of days. But mi'ut sicha is that one is supposed to reduce one's chatter. However, in Tanakh, there is another usage of it, yeah?
Yitzhak.
Exactly. exactly. For prayer specifically, Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basadeh is understood as he is speaking to God. There are others. Tefillah Le'ani Ki Atof V'lefnei Hashem Yishpoch Sicho. When the pauper spills out his siach or sicha before God, or in Kedusha, right, in the liturgy, Kinoam Siach Sarfei Kodesh is their praise of God. So it does have this other usage, although you're right. I mean, the word in Hebrew today for a dialogue is du-siach. Although the truth is, the fact that it's two-way is the du part, not the siach part. So, yes, but you're right. The word sicha as prayer is an interesting thing, but the commentaries do seem very comfortable with it because it's supposed to be parallel to yirah in the first half of the sentence. Right? If the first half is about fear, reverence, awe, then sicha has to mean something more than chatter in the second half. Having said that, in terms of what he's doing here, one way to look at this is exactly what you're saying. What everybody here is saying, you are robbing people of their faith. If you take a look on your sheet, I brought you Ralbag in his approach to it in source number 7, the top of the second side. He says, Tafer mehehamon yirat Hashem yitbarach. You will nullify reverence for God, and I translate yirah as reverence. Sometimes it's fear, sometimes it's reverence. It's a tricky word to translate. But you will nullify their reverence of God. Ki ha-hamon l'chulshat sichlam lo yir'u me'asot ra'ot. El midaga penyani shem Hashem yitbarach. He says the masses, they don't really grasp necessarily, like, why things are bad to do, and they're not necessarily going to be so ethical, except that they're afraid of getting punished. So they're thinking, if I do a bad thing, I'm going to get punished. So he says, Ulazek shetomar shelo yo'il atzedek, shelo yavou elu haraot, elo mishem b'maharachto b'et halidashi yavou ehu. He says, when you tell people that righteousness doesn't actually prevent bad things from happening to you, that if you're born under a certain star, it's going to happen, and that's just the way it is, then they're not going to serve God anymore. And they're not going to do good things anymore. You nullify reverence for God from the masses. This is sort of the response to the one who pulls away the curtain, right? The one who, in The Wizard of Oz, pulls away the curtain, or, you know, the one who cries out, the emperor has no clothes. No, people need to think he does, because if they don't, then they're going to be lawless. Is this a really good argument? I mean, is this something you can actually say to a human being who's suffering? Don't give voice to your suffering because it's going to make other people less pious. And not even less pious, that's not true. Less falsely pious. Shana.
It's a terrible argument.
Yeah.
Not the least because it undermines the whole scheme of scaramanish or word punishment. Because if you live in a world in which punishment is sure and immediate and obvious, what merit is there in doing right? It's like not stealing the gun of the police officer in the police station. Good job, right?
Right. We'll give you a check mark for that day.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's an answer that gives you more problems than it solves.
Right. It's precisely. I mean, it's number one, it encourages a shallow form of religion for everybody. Now, he's saying, well, that's the best they can do. So I would argue he's right that it's better that than nothing. Better that people should say, I want to do the right thing because it gets me lollipops, than that people should go out doing the wrong thing. I think I'd accept that. I may not be happy about a world like that, but I can accept that if it's a choice between one or the other, that's the choice that society has made, right? Society uses punishment as a deterrent, whether they're succeeding or not is another story. But society uses deterrent as a means of discouraging crime because it recognizes that there are people who simply need the deterrent and we can't have crime going on, so that's what we're going to do. As opposed to telling people, don't steal because it's immoral, when there's a certain sector of society who are going to say, too bad, I'm going to say, don't steal because you're going to get thrown in jail, and hope that that works. That part of it I can live with. The part that I can't live with is that really what you say to Job? This person who's suffering, is that really the best you can do? So I turn to the Talmud, which actually takes Eliphaz's statement differently and in a much more profound way. Take a look, please, at source number 8. And for those who read Toronto Torah, this actually gave me my Parsha article for this week. So the front page article builds on this. Amar Rava, the sage Rava said, Bikesh Iov liftor et kol ha'olam kulo min hadin. Job desired to exempt the entire world from judgment. In other words, to say, God, you can't judge anybody. Why? They're building on a verse from Job from earlier in the book. Amar Lefanav, Job said, Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Barata Shor Parsotav Sdukot, Barata Chamor Parsotav Klutot, you created the ox, which has split hooves, and you created the donkey, which has sealed hooves. What's this business with the hooves?
Kosher
and non-kosher, correct. Split hooves means it's kosher, sealed hooves means it's non-kosher. God, you made the ox as a kosher animal, and you made the donkey as a non-kosher animal. Sorry?
Kosher or an abomination?
Kosher. Meaning the terms used, you will never find the word kosher used in the context of food in Tanakh because they just say you shall eat or you shall not eat. The word kasher is used to mean something that is eligible. So that's where we end up using it for that. They use the word tameh and tahor, pure and impure they use. That's true. So he says, Barata Gan Eden, Barata Gehinom, you created the Garden of Eden, you created Gehinom, the place of punishment. Barata Tzadikim, Barata Rishayim, and you created righteous people, and you created wicked people. Now, the Talmud separately discusses what God dictates before somebody is born, and it talks about God dictating whether somebody will be wise, whether somebody will be wealthy, but it specifically stops short of saying that God dictates righteous and wicked, saying that that's not in God's hands. Hakol bidei shemayim chutz miyirat shemayim. Everything is in God's hands except for this. But that's what they put in Job's mouth. When Job says earlier in the book, he says, Al datcha ki ersha. It's up to you, God, whether I do something wicked or not. The Talmud says what he's saying is, just like you made that animal kosher and that animal non-kosher, and there's nothing they can do about it, you made the wicked and you made the righteous. People do not have free will. That's the allegation that they put in Job's mouth in this passage, based on that verse that I just mentioned. Mima keval yatcha, so who can stop you, God? This is just what you do. And what did Job's friends, for whatever friendship is worth here, what did Job's friends respond to him? The way they take it is that the word sicha means not prayer, but rather speaking Torah, which you can find examples of elsewhere as well. I wouldn't get hung up on the word sicha. But what they're saying is, you are nullifying, you are canceling reverence for God because you eliminate tigra, reduce, eliminate sicha before God, meaning Torah before God. Barak Adosh Baruch Hu Yetzer Hara. Yes, God created the Yetzer Hara, this inclination in a person to say, I'm going to do what I want to do. But Baralo Torah Tavlin, God also created Torah as the antidote. Tavlin is spices; it's a reference to a medicine. And the idea that the Talmud is trying to express here is their response to Job is you do have free will. That's the point of the mitzvot that God gave us, is for us to grow beyond that part of us that says, "Don't control me. Don't tell me what to do. I want to do my own thing." And that's what it's there for. And so what the Talmud suggests is that Eliphaz is not saying to Job, this very shallow, don't keep saying these things because you're going to shake people's faith and they're going to stop doing good things and they're going to start doing bad things. But rather what he's saying to Job is, you are eliminating the concept of Yira, the concept of awe of God. You are eliminating the value of Torah. You're saying that there's no merit to a person's Torah. In other words, what you're saying is, we are created as we are. We are born with an id that wants to be fed. And that's all we are for our entire lives. And it's not true. We are able to grow. This is already not just a criticism of Job, like, Job, you think you're so smart and you're not smart. This is a substantive response that he's saying to him, you can be more than this. you're not a beast that is determined to be kosher or non-kosher at birth and is stuck with it for life. This is something that you can actually, you can change.
Did Job ever say that? Did Job ever really express the fact that he felt he was fixed and had no choice? He was saying, I've done good and I'm being punished. He didn't say, I have no choice.
Yeah. So what he did say were two things. One, the verse that they're jumping on here was when he said, Al da'atcha ki ersha. He turned to God and said, Al da'atcha ki ersha, which can be read, as the Talmud does, it's up to you, God, whether I sin. In other words, I don't control what I do. But more explicitly, he has said several times that no one can be perfect and that people are always going to stumble in things. That's not the same thing as saying I have no free will. But it is saying that sin is guaranteed. To which Eliphaz is saying, that leads you to say, well, then why bother? And I don't think that's an accurate approach, because you should bother, because you have the means of developing reverence, you have the means through Torah of improving. So I prefer the Talmud's take on what Eliphaz is doing here. I think he's not saying a shallow statement of, be careful what you say, because you're shaking people's faith. I think he's saying something substantive to Job of, your path denies that human beings can improve, and I believe human beings can indeed improve and can indeed grow. Continuing here, because we have a couple of minutes, and I want to make sure to finish at least the first part of his speech. He's saying here, Job, your words betray your wickedness in what you're saying here. When you, what you say are things that are empty, they're not nourishing. You are, as the Talmud reads it, you are saying that there is no Yira, you're eliminating reverence, you're eliminating Torah. And then he says, with great imagery, there's mouth imagery here in sentences 5 and 6. Ki ye'aleif avoncha picha v'tivchar l'shon arumim. There are two ways that you can take this line here in sentence 5. The bad way to take it is, ye'aleif means to teach others. So, ye'aleif avoncha picha, your mouth teaches your sin to other people. V'tivchar l'shon arumim, you choose the language of the clever to teach other people your sins. You are promoting wrong to the people who are listening to you speak. Yarshiacha picha, velo ani. And he says, your mouth indicts you. Your mouth labels you wicked. I am not the one calling you wicked, Job. Don't blame us for calling you wicked. Your own words are doing that. Usfatecha yanuvach. Your lips respond to you. So you notice the mouth imagery. Picha lashon, picha svatecha. That he's doing here. But what he's saying is, it's you. You're the one. Now, how has Job used cleverness? What is it about Job that has used cleverness to try to conceal his wickedness? Chapters 12 to 14. When he turned to all the visitors and said, you call me the wicked one. I am the pious one. All of you are saying false things about God. Right? You are idolatrous. I'm the one who is speaking to the truth of God. God actually approves of what I am saying. So he calls that Lashon Arumim, the language of the clever. That's one way to read this last clause here. The other way to read it is as Rashi does. He says, he agrees with the first part of sentence 5. That your mouth teaches of your sin, but he says, Vitibchar Lashon Arumim. Rashi is very sensitive, like all the things we did in Medrash last year, to language. The Vav is a problem, right? Hebrew speakers. What's wrong with that Vav? Not the ant problem. No. Shane is going to tell me in a second. Nope. Ki aleif avon chapicha v'tivchar lashon arumim is future or imperative, right? In other words, what it's saying is not, and you have done this, but either you will do this or you should do this. So Rashi says it's a should. To be arum, we usually render as to be clever, going all the way back to the snake in the Garden of Eden, who's described as being clever in a very negative way. But he says, you should be more clever with your speech, is the way Rashi reads this. It's an instruction. if you don't like being called wicked, maybe you should, you know, take notice of the way your words are coming out. That's essentially what he's saying to Job. But to sum up what we've done here, we've seen, again, I gave an outline of round one again just because it's been so long, but starting from round two, he's going to say to Job that the wicked people suffer, and that's going to be the major theme of round two. So we spent some time talking about why it would be valuable to tell Job that, and we have to see how this plays out. We talked about it maybe as a message for Job personally or as a statement about justice in general. We left an open-ended question of, does he really believe that wicked people suffer? And that's something that we have to visit again through the chapter. He began his speech by saying that Job's words betray his wickedness. What he's saying is empty. What he's saying is not wise. What he's saying is like wind. His own words either endanger the reverence of the listeners, or alternatively, his own words undermine the idea that human beings can improve themselves and can grow and can be righteous and can be good. And he concluded by saying, your own mouth is spreading this. Your own mouth indicates the wickedness that's inside of you, Job. I also brought you on your sheet, we're not going to do it aloud here, but it's worth taking a look at. No, I didn't bring it. Haha, just kidding. But the Gemara in the beginning of Sa'no, I realize I omitted it for space. But the Gemara in the beginning of Psachim reads it as Rashi does when it says, "Vitivchar, you should choose Lashon Arumim, the language of the clever." The way the Gemara reads it is, you should use clean language. And what it does is it says that when people speak, they should choose language that is clean and language that is terse. And that's the meaning of language of the clever, language of the wise. So they take it out of context completely as a general instruction. Worth noting. But we will pick up, God willing, next week with more of Eliphaz's speech and this idea of the wicked suffering. I will note just one thing.